For the first quarter of the year, I had the opportunity of teaching in the book of Hebrews, and it was my goal starting out to get through the book, and that goal did not come to fruition because there was so much contained in the book of Hebrews that I really felt like it needed some more time. So I only got through about 8 chapters in that study, and I've been asked to continue on with the book of Hebrews. I wanted to use the opportunity this morning in the form of our sermon to talk a little bit more about that book. We talked about the writer and the purpose. And if you'll remember, the purpose of the writer in putting and pinning together the book of Hebrews was to encourage this group of Jewish Christians, new converts, who were being persecuted by their culture that was becoming increasingly hostile to their new faith. They left the old law, they came to the new one, and things just got tougher for them. And I think that that is something that we can relate to in our current circumstance in the United States today. Our culture is becoming increasingly hostile to Christian faith and Christian principles that we hold so dear. And unless God comes in and steps in with some miraculous intervention, I think things are going to continue to get worse, and there's going to be increasing pressure on Christians to give in on our faith, to punt, to go back to an old lifestyle instead of holding on. And so this writer sits down and he writes the book of Hebrews, and he wants to give strategies to the readers of the book for dealing with persecution and hardship. And what's crazy about the way that he does that is that he only has one strategy. He only has one bullet in the gun. And that's to keep the needle right on Jesus and keep hitting repeat, repeat, repeat. I want you to know who He is. I want you to fill your minds with Christ and know why He's greater. Like a diamond, hold Jesus up and hold Him up to the light and keep turning it, looking at a new facet and showing you who He is and how He shines greater. In chapters 1 and 2, we find that Jesus is greater than the angels. He's a better messenger. In chapter 3 and 4, we find that He's greater than Moses. He's a better deliverer of people. In chapters 5, 6, and 7, we find that He's greater than the priests and the high priest of the Old Testament law. And finally, we come to chapter 9. So if you'd like to turn your Bibles to chapter 9, this is where we're going to be this morning. Chapter 9, we're going to be dealing with one part of Jesus' ministry, and that is His death. Very, very important part. And there's only three major questions that I want to ask and answer from what I find from the chapter 9 in the book of Hebrews. Number one, why did Jesus have to die? Number two, what benefits accrue from His death? And number three, who are the benefits? Who are the benefactors that come because of that? Three very simple things. Let's start off with number one. Why did Jesus have to die? Let's start in verse 15 and follow along with me. And for this reason, He is the mediator of the new covenant. And I want to stop right there. I know we didn't get very far, but let's stop right there. It says, for this reason, He's the mediator of the new covenant. What is the reason? For what reason? Well, if you come back up to verses 1 through 14, we find Him writing about all of the things in the tabernacle, all of the furnishings, all of the gold, all the things that were crafted, and how those things served as a representative, and they had blood splattered on them to sanctify. Look at verse 13. Sanctifies for the purifying of what? The flesh. All of this Old Testament system, all of these earthly physical things serve to sanctify, purify the flesh. How much greater is Christ in the New Testament? What does His sacrifice do for us? Look at verse 14. It not only cleanses the flesh, but He can cleanse our what? Our conscience. He can make our flesh and our bodies right, and He can make our minds and our hearts pure and clean as well. And that's why He brings in an entirely new covenant. The old one was about the flesh. Christ's covenant is about the soul and it's about the spirit. And for this reason, He is the mediator of a new covenant. And how did He do that? How did Christ bring in a new covenant? Well, it says, by means of death. For the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive what? The promise of the internal inheritance. Okay, so it's because of his sacrifice that he could accomplish the establishment of a new covenant by means of death. So, I haven't answered the question yet. Why did Jesus have to die? What's the point of his death? Let's continue on verses 16 through 17, for we find out. For where there is a testament, there must also be the necessity of the death of the testator. For a testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all while the testator lives. Look at what he's saying here. Reason number one, the reason Christ died is because all of the benefits that Christ came to give you were not triggered until what point in time? His death. All the benefits that Christ came to give you were not triggered until his death. See how he did this too? To explain this, he used something they understood. Who in the room today does not know what a will is? Do we know how a will works? Right? Somebody sits down and they write out, upon my death, I want these things to go to this person, these things to go to that person. So let's take an example. And I can use Dad because I don't think he'll mind. But let's say Dad sits down and he writes out his will and he says, in my will, I'm going to give my land, my house, my tractors, my cows to my two kids, Eric and Emily. And me and Emily get together and we say, all right, we got a lot of benefits coming from this will. So me and Emily get together and we drive down to the courthouse here at Christian County in Ozark and we hand that will over to Judge Bacon, who I think handles the probate issues. And we hand him that will and we say, you see all these things that we're supposed to get? We'd like to have those. And he looks at it and he says, well, this all looks good, but there's one problem. Your dad's still alive. This will doesn't mean anything until your dad is dead. Until you can prove his death, the testament does not take effect until the death of the testator. Very simple, practical explanation that he walks through here in verses 17 through 18. And by the way, the word covenant, when we say new covenant, old covenant, that same Greek word is up here, is the same word as will. A covenant is a will. God is binding that on himself and on the people that he makes it with. The new covenant is like a last will and testament, and it does not get triggered until, and those benefits do not accrue until Christ's death. That concept of a will being triggered by a death, when did it begin? Look at verse 18. What does it say? Therefore, not even the first covenant was dedicated without blood. Moses brings in the new covenant and he says, something has got to die. And what's the death certificate? What's the proof that Moses has to establish the old covenant? What's the proof he has? He says, I'm going to show you the blood. I've got to establish a death for all of the benefits of this old covenant to take effect. And that's always been true. Even our modern laws of wills and probates, estates and trusts, go back to the BC era. Reason number two. Why did he have to die? If Christ didn't die, we could not be forgiven. And before I want to unpack that thought, I want you to look at verses 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22. What is the common thread in every one of those verses? Blood. It's in 18, 19, 20, 21, and it comes out twice in 22. Six times in five verses, we see the word blood brought up in talking about the establishment of this covenant. And this isn't just me trying to be sensational or graphic about this. My job is to preach the whole counsel of God. And when I see the word blood used over and over and over again, I think we need to stop and talk about it. The Old Covenant, it had over 1,000+ years of sacrificial system. It's been estimated that there was over 1 million gallons of blood, a million animals that were sacrificed. A bull had about 2 to 3 gallons of blood. A goat had about 1 quart of blood. And how did they, when they went to sacrifice these animals, how did they do it? They cut their throat and they let all the blood drain out. So much blood that on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, or the Passover, there was so much blood that they had to create a blood aqueduct to flow from the temple down to the Kidron Valley. A sacrificial sewage system to take care of all of that blood. The Old Covenant sails on a sea of blood. Look at verse 21. Back to verse 20, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you. Then likewise he sprinkled with the blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of ministry." This is what Moses did. You remember back in the Old Testament, Moses and the children of Israel were wandering for 40 years in the wilderness, and God said, "I need a place to dwell with my people." And so he gives Moses these meticulous instructions about how to build the tabernacle. It's going to be this big, it's going to be this tall, it's going to have this many curtains. They're going to be woven and sewn like this. Meticulous detail, tapestries, pomegranates engraved in there. Pure white robes for the priests. Pure white turbans, the Urim and the Thummim on their breastplate. And the temple furnishings hammered out in bronze and dipped in solid gold. God put all of this in the hands of the craftsmen, and it was so beautiful. And the first order of business after creating all these beautiful things, what did Moses do? What do we find in verse 21? Likewise, he sprinkled with the blood what?
All these things that they meant.
You bet. These things were beautiful. Brand new house for God. Larry and Valita, you just had an open house, right?
This afternoon.
Rachel and Brandon are moving into a brand new house. Valita, how would you feel if I came over to your open house after services today with a big old pot of blood and I came in with a big paintbrush and started slopping it all over the place? How would you feel about that in your brand new house? Yeah, you would be too. We got this brand new house for God and we come in and we throw blood all over the place. Why? Why do we do this? Why would God ask Moses to do this? Verse 22, according to the law, almost all things are purified with what? Blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. He put that blood on it to purify the temple, to cleanse it. He says, almost everything. I find that interesting. According to the law, almost all things are purified with blood. The law provided an exception for those who could not provide a blood sacrifice. If you didn't have the financial means to purchase a bull or a goat or a pigeon or a turtle dove, what could you do? If you couldn't afford to buy those things, the law made a mechanism. If you were that poor, you could go out into the field where the farmers hadn't harvested the corners and you could glean the grain from those fields, and you could bring that grain in, and it was called the grain offering, and you could give that. Almost everything was purified by blood, except for those grain offerings. So the question I want to ask is, why is God's covenant so bloody? And I think it's really important for us to talk about this. Because you see, God paints these pictures, these graphic illustrations, and one of them is the sacrificial system. I can think of two reasons why the Old Covenant is so bloody. Number one, because the wages of sin is death. Every bull that was sacrificed, every lamb that was slain, every goat that was slaughtered, every pigeon that had its head plucked off, produced this stream of blood that the Old Covenant sailed on. And that stream of blood was screaming out Sin is horrible. It's horrific. It brings death. This is not something that God gets pleasure in, like the pagans did. God, in the new covenant, when Christ was on the cross and he was dying and bloody, God couldn't even look on Jesus. It doesn't make God happy. But the sacrifices in this blood wasn't for God, was it? Who was the blood for? It was for the people. It was for us. When we get to the new covenant and we see this come into place, God is saying, and even in looking back, I want you to watch as this innocent little lamb is slain. I want you to see how it's fighting for its life, how it's gasping and struggling for air, and there's blood coming out of it. I want it to turn your stomach and you to be nauseated by it. I want you to feel this feeling that sin is terrible. The wages of sin is death. Think about how the priest must have felt. They wake up in the morning, they wash, they clean, they put on this white robe, this white hat, brilliant white, and then what's their job for the day? They're gonna kill these animals. They're gonna sacrifice these animals. Their hair, their beard, their hands, their white clothes covered in blood at the end of the day. Think how they felt. They got to see firsthand and deal with all this blood. Surely they should know that the wages of sin is death. But then I think that there's a second reason why the old covenant was so bloody. And it's this, and it's very simple. Forgiveness is costly. What does it cost to receive forgiveness? Doesn't cost a dime to receive it. But what does it cost to give it or to grant forgiveness? Well, it costs Christ His life. And even for us, it can cost a lot. You know, sometimes we do this with our friends or our spouses or whatever. They've wronged us or they've said something that's hurt us. And we hold on to that, don't we? Kind of gives us an edge, this kind of feeling inside that we've got something. But if we're willing to say, I forgive you of that and move on, that can cost us our pride sometimes and our ego to let go of that and move on. Forgiveness is costly. Let's look at question number two. What benefits accrue because of Jesus' death? Number one, I think that it secures our access to God. Look with me in verses 23 and 24. Therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things in heaven should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has not entered the holy place made with hands, which are the copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. So Christ died to give us access to God. But he says something strange there in verse 23. He says that the copies and the things that are in heaven have to be purified. Why would something in heaven need to be purified? That's where God is at. God is holy. Everything around Him is holy. Why the purification in heaven? What I think the writer of Hebrews is trying to say is that we have this holy habitation with God. And we have people pressing into the kingdom of heaven. But for all of these people, all of us Christians, to be pressing into that, what has to take place? We have to be purified. We have to be cleansed before we can come into heaven. And I think Christ steps forward and He says, I will do that. I will cleanse these people with my blood so that they can be holy and in heaven. But then He also does another thing. He secures our assurance. It's all about giving us this blessed assurance. Verses 25 through 26. Not that He should offer Himself often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with the blood of another. He would then have to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the end of the ages, He has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of Himself. His sacrifice was once and for all. Never again was it needed. And I think that the power of Christ's sacrifice should give us blessed assurance. Notice what he says there in verse 26. That he came to put away what?
Sin.
Sin. And I think it's important here. There's a difference between sin and sins. And we've talked about this in our class over the last few months. And I'm going to say this a couple different ways because I really want it to sink in. Jesus appeared to put away sin, singular. That is the sin problem. We have a problem with sinning because we have a sin problem in our lives, is one way to say it. The root is sin. The fruit is sinning. My sinful actions are merely symptomatic of a root cause, a deeper issue in my life. And Christ's death was to put away the root. Put away the root so he can deal with the fruit that comes out of that. So, does that mean that we're sinless? I think I maybe want to go back one. If Christ deals with the root problem of sin, does that mean that we're sinless? Think about 1 John chapter 1, verses 7 and 8. He says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and what? The truth is not in us. And he goes on, but if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus Christ does what? Cleanses us. A perpetual cleansing, purification from all sin. Christ is working in each and every one of our lives if we have obeyed Him to root out and get rid of sin. And the reason I've got the picture of this tree up here is this is the picture that I get in my head. We're like a tree that's been planted. We've got roots that have gone down, and we've got fruits that we are to bear as Christians. Before we become Christians, though, our life produces fruits of unrighteousness, worth nothing, should just be cut down and thrown into the fire. But Christ comes and He cleanses us. And He does that by going around the base of that tree, and He's going to cut at the roots, cut at the source, the sin problem. Now, our tree may not die immediately because we still have that sap flowing in us from our previous life. But eventually, that's going to come out as Christ continually works on us and cuts out that sin, and we work with Him. One of the passages I really like, I've got at the bottom, is from Philippians 1, verse 6. We have confidence in Him who has begun a good work, that He will finish it in the day of Jesus Christ. That sap is going to come out. We're going to have a new life. The cutting of the roots is painful for now, but it will yield the peaceable fruits of righteousness in the days ahead. What will His death accomplish? Verse 27, 28. And is it appointed for men to die once, but after this, what? The judgment. So Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who were eagerly awaiting for Him, He will appear a second time, apart from sin, for salvation. I want to camp on verse 27 for a few minutes, because I think that there are three very important truths that can come out of that short little verse 27. Truth number one from verse 27. Everyone has an appointment with death. It's a one-to-one ratio between those who are living and those who will die. It's non-negotiable. And I don't want to be a downer here, but that's just the way it is. And he calls it what? He calls it an appointment. Every day we make appointments. In our phone, in our calendar, in a notepad somewhere. We make appointments for our lives, for how we want things to go. And we make a lot of them. But is this an appointment that you'll get to make? Do you get to write down that date and time? You don't. This is an appointment that God makes. And He has already made the appointment. Did you know that? Did you think about that? Psalms 139 and 16 is going to come up here in just a minute. I'll go ahead and read it. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they were all written, the days fashioned for me, yet when there were, should be none of them. Even before we were created and made in our mothers, God knew exactly how many days and numbered them that we would be here. He knew what was going to be on your birth certificate, and He knows the date that's going to be on your death certificate, even before you were made. You have a certain amount of days, and no amount of jazzercise or kale salads or essential oils will change that. We may think that we may prolong it, but Christ and God already have that day down in the books. Truth number two, everyone only has one appointment. This is not a trick question. There's no reincarnation. There's no purgatory. There are no do-overs. That's why Moses says in Psalm 90:12, teach us to number our days. God, you've already numbered them. You know exactly how long they're going to be. Teach us to do the same things so that we may gain a heart of wisdom. We spend a lot of time on things that just really don't matter. As Dwayne stood up here and quoted multiple times on things that just don't matter, that's just about a zero. And that's time that we will never, ever get back. I don't care if it's a day, a minute. That's time that we'll never get back, that we can't go back and spend with our families, or time that we can't go back into reading the Word of God and studying and meditating on Him. You waste it now and it's gone. Teach us to number our days, Moses asks in Psalm 90. Truth number three. After our appointment with death comes what? The judgment. Death is not the end, but it's the beginning. And there are a lot of people that we know, go to school with, go to work with, who live in our neighborhoods, that think that this earth life is all that there is. 75, 80, 90 years, and that's it. They don't believe that God has created them for eternity. They don't believe it. I want to tell you something. Every single person knows that God created them and He made them for eternity. Everybody knows that. Now, some people will deny it. The Scriptures say that they suppress the truth. But that doesn't change the fact that the truth still exists. You got to hold it down like that. Like that big beach ball under the water, constantly have to suppress the truth to keep it down. I want you to think about this in Romans. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known about God, the fact that He created them and made them for eternity, is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Does anybody have an excuse for not knowing God created them for eternity when God makes it known to them? You don't. The only thing that you can do is suppress it. If I find in myself desires that this world cannot satisfy, the only logical conclusion that I can make is that I was made for another world. Let's get back to the last question, and this is the one that we're going to end with. What are the benefits? All right, so we talked about why Jesus had to die. We talked about the benefits that would accrue. And now we're going to talk about who those benefits are for. Let's look again at verse 28. So Christ was offered once to bear the sins of how many? Many. He died for everybody. To those who eagerly wait for Him, He will appear a second time apart from sin for salvation. We know that Christ died for everybody, but we also find in this verse here that He's coming back for how many? Those who eagerly are waiting for Him. Let me say it another way. One of the proofs that you're a Christian is that you are eagerly waiting to meet Christ again. For what? For salvation. Do you love Jesus Christ? Absolutely you do. Do you love the benefits that He is giving you right now and the benefits that are going to come because of the last will and testament He put into force because of His death? Absolutely you love those benefits. They're fantastic. But you know what's better than all of the benefits of a will? What could be the one thing that's more important than the will? The person who wrote it. You know, I know some of you have lost mothers and fathers who have written wills and have bequeathed you or left you with all kinds of things. Maybe it was a little, maybe it was a whole lot. But would you be willing to trade all of the benefits of the will for the one who wrote it? Absolutely. I don't care about that stuff. I'd rather have the person who wrote the will. When we think about our spiritual lives and what we can have and the benefits of that, yes, it's good to have blessings. We can say that it's great that we can be rescued from hell. It's great to say that we can escape eternal punishment. But what's even more important than that? The ability to be with Christ. Philippians chapter 3, verse 10, Paul says, I want to be with Him. The benefits are great, but I want to be with Christ. I want to know Him. I want to know the power of His resurrection. And I want to share in His sufferings. To live is Christ. To die is gain. And that had to be so frustrating for Satan, right? Kill him. Gain. Well, then let him live. I'll live for Christ. What do you do? My desire, Paul said, is to be with Christ. You know the thing about wills? This is the last slide here. The thing about wills and the people who write them is that there is one concept that's always been true. You have to choose, and you only get one. It's an either-or type of a deal. You can either have the person, or you have the will and the benefits. You can't have both. This is the thing that is such great news about Jesus' last will and testament. And that's the fact that it's not an either-or. It's a both-and. You don't have to choose between the glorious inheritance that He has laid up for you and Jesus Christ Himself. You get both. What a promise. That's God's promise to you. This morning, if you don't have those promises because you have not been washed in the blood of Christ, you don't have His purifying blood that cleanses you and cuts the roots of sin so that that old sap can come out, and you can start bearing fruits of righteousness and peace in your life, why are you waiting? You don't have access to the benefits of the will, nor do you have it to Him. Come to the fount. Come to that fountain that is shed for you, that was pierced and bled and died. Jesus Christ, our Redeemer, who brings salvation. Won't you let your request be known as we stand and sing an invitation song?